The television journalist Barbara Walters titled her memoir with a single word that she says describes her life: audition.
Well, I really have felt that I have been auditioning most of my life.
She felt like she was auditioning even when she was famous, when she worked for NBC's morning program as something called the Today Girl, and later as the first woman to co-anchor a nightly newscast, and then making millions for ABC by interviewing world leaders and celebrities. Long before she became a celebrity, Barbara Walters knew them. Her father owned successful nightclubs in Boston and Miami and New York.
You know, there was such a dichotomy because on the one hand, here was this glamorous life of nightclubs and gorgeous showgirls and big stars, Frank Sinatra and Milton Berle. And I'm sure it's a life that people would look at and envy and think, oh, wasn't that terrific? I didn't want that. I wanted a normal life. I wanted a daddy who was home.
Because at home, Barbara Walters writes, was a troubled family and an older sister who was described as having mental retardation.
And my mother and father were very different. It was a troubled marriage, and there was always the sadness of my sister while they tried to figure out what would work out to make her happier. So what appeared on the surface to be a charmed and beautiful life wasn't. When I do interviews myself, I so often ask people about their childhood because I think it's so much a key to their future.
When you write about your father being away all the time and working very late hours and absurd hours, of course, that's partly the life he chose, the career that he had to make a living, but it makes me wonder if he also just didn't like being in that home.
I don't know. I don't think my father and mother had a good marriage. I don't think he wanted really to stay home, but if he did, he couldn't. His business was at night.
Wasn't there an occasion when you became a mediator of sorts between your father and your mother?
Well, that happened very often. My mother would tell me all her problems, and there was this time when she said, your father wants to separate. He wants a divorce. Go talk to him. So I took my sister, and we went down to the Latin Quarter. It was probably early afternoon, mid-afternoon, and I asked him very tearfully not to leave us. And he said he would think about it. And I then took my sister to the movies. I thought, we have to get away from this. And by the time I came home, my mother said, your father has decided not to leave. And when I look back on it, it says something about the man that I didn't appreciate.
You write about a question that you have used again and again.
What's the biggest misconception about you?
Why start with that question if you're talking to some famous person?
Well, I don't usually start with it. But there are times when someone will say, I really don't want to talk about that. And yet, they really do want to talk about it. And if you say to someone, what's the biggest misconception? Very often, they will come out with the very thing that people want to know that they have not wanted to talk about. I mean, I remember when the first time I asked it practically, it was with the opera singer Maria Callas, who had been in love with Aristotle Onassis, who had married Jacqueline Kennedy, okay? And she did not want to talk about Aristotle Onassis or Jacqueline Kennedy. And I said to her, what's the biggest misconception about you? And she launched into a whole thing about Aristotle Onassis and Jackie Kennedy. And I thought, how interesting. I must ask that of other people because usually they feel that they are not totally understood. I remember Sophia Loren saying with an accent that I can't do, nothing is misunderstood. Everybody really knows me, but most people don't feel that way.
Well, I love the question because it seems like a total softball question, but it's not. It's a way of getting around someone's defenses.
It's also a way of bringing up a lot of rumors about them that they have to address. You know, you can say, you may have heard that this has been said or that's been said, but what is the biggest misconception about you? It's a very good opening question, but I don't ask it in the beginning of an interview. You have to sort of get in there, and it's a good question towards the end.
Well, now that we're towards the end, what is the biggest misconception about you?
Well, I think the biggest misconception about me had been that I was this person in great authority. I think the biggest misconception until now has been that I've had this blessed life. That part of it's true, but that it's all been smooth sailing and isn't it wonderful and hasn't it just been the easiest way? I wanted people to know that my life too has had not just great ups, but great downs. And maybe my story will help them survive theirs. And I hope it'll be a very good read and a very entertaining read.
Is this a misconception, which I might summarize this way? Barbara Walters just does these puffy celebrity interviews that have cheapened the culture. I mean, you seem to go out of your way in this book to there's photograph after photograph. You've interviewed five presidents in a row, just to give one example.
I think if you only watch the specials, you might have that feeling, Steve. But if you watch 25 years on 2020, to see that I had interviewed almost every head of state of importance, every president of importance, every murderer of importance, and that's all in the book. I think if you've only watched the specials, you might feel that I did celebrities. They certainly didn't cheapen the culture. The interviews that I did with celebrities and still do, I think, are provocative and important. So I don't think that's a perception of me.
Did you get to a point at the end of the specials and the latter part where you found it difficult to do as many serious interviews as you wanted to do?
Well, it's not just that I did, but we all know now that many of the news magazines, what they're interested most are celebrities, and especially celebrities with problems. It's changed. It's very hard to get people to watch a head of state now. I mean, there aren't that many they're interested. If you say, have an interview with the president, the sort of feeling is, oh, yeah, who cares, another one.
Did that happen to you?
So news has changed. It did happen to me in 2020, which is why I decided to leave 4 years ago. I really didn't want to. I didn't want to go after the big get and the next big get and the next big get. But the days of doing...
You're saying you had an interview with the president in 2004 and they said, no, thank you? The network?
Yes.
What was the story? What happened?
I received a phone call from a woman named Mary Kay Letourneau, who had just gotten out of 7 years in prison, where she had served because she had had a relationship with her very young male student. And she said that she would do her first interview with me. So it was Mary Kay Letourneau, the president. The president, Mary Kay Letourneau. And you'll have to read the book to find out which one we chose.
Don't you dare tell. I don't. Okay, I won't say.
Okay.
Won't say. Barbara Walters, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, and I'm glad you've let me audition one more time with you.
This spring, three renowned women writers are asking readers to take a leap of imagination. Joyce Carol Oates has a new collection of stories in which she envisions the last days of famous authors. Jeanette Winterson's novel takes a journey through outer space, and Ursula Le Guin reawakens a poet long dead. Our reviewer Ellen Chews has read all three.
Reading through new work by these wildly imaginative women was a thrill, an adventure, a privilege. Joyce Carol Oates's collection is called Wild Nights, and it lives up to the title, which she borrows from Emily Dickinson. Her fiction focuses on the last days of five writers we admire: Dickinson, Edgar Allan Poe, Henry James, Mark Twain, Ernest Hemingway. Each of the stories becomes distinctive and gripping. Take Poe's hallucination about a lighthouse in Patagonia. Oates conjures it up with horrors as fine and frightening as anything in the author's actual work, and Poe winds up dying as pathetically as the other men on Oates's roster. Toward the end of his life, Twain has a haunting rendezvous with adolescent girls in New York Central Park. Henry James falls in love while caring for veterans suffering in a London hospital. Hemingway meets his end in a string of paranoid fantasies. The paradox here, in their last days, Oates brings these writers ferociously back to life, even if she goes a bit far with a poem-spouting robot who keeps the personality of Emily Dickinson alive and running. There's another female robot named Spike in Jeanette Winterson's new novel, The Stone Gods. She's longing after Billy Crusoe, the main character in this story of worlds dying and being reborn. Billy and Spike board a spaceship bound for a new planet where Earth's culture might just get a second chance. But then, boom, the new world explodes and sends Billy back to Easter Island in the 18th century, site of those stone gods of the title. Because of plot turns like this, first-time readers of Winterson may find themselves a little baffled. "We make plans," says Billy. "We try to control, but the whole thing is random." Like all robot sidekicks, Spike doesn't quite agree. "This is a quantum universe," she replies. "All you can do is intervene." That's what Winterson herself seems to do. She intervenes in the conventional form of the novel. So does Ursula Le Guin in her delightful new book, Lavinia. She borrows figures straight out of Virgil's great Latin epic, the Aeneid. The story goes back more than 2,000 years, and don't worry, it stays there. As he lies dying aboard ship off the coast of Italy, Virgil appears to a young Italian princess named Lavinia. He proceeds to tell her the Cliff Notes version of the Aeneid and bring readers up to date in case they've set this epic aside. Basically, says Virgil, King Turnus from a nearby territory desires to marry her, but instead Lavinia will wed a stranger arriving with a fleet of ships on a nearby coast. That stranger is, of course, the defeated Trojan warrior Aeneas. He'll soon make landfall in this country where his gods have told him to found a new city. The magic here is that we get to watch Aeneas' story unfold from Lavinia's point of view. All my life might seem a weaving, torn out of the loom unfinished, Lavinia tells us. I was a spinner, not a weaver, but I have learned to weave. So has Ursula Le Guin. So have each of these extraordinarily gifted writers.
The books are Lavinia by Ursula Le Guin, The Stone Gods by Jeanette Winterson, and Wild Nights by Joyce Carol Oates. Our reviewer, Ellen Chews, teaches writing at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia.
Marshall University in West Virginia is debating whether to accept a $1 million donation from BB&T Bank's Charitable Foundation. The money would go toward teaching courses at the business college based on the economic philosophy of the writer Ayn Rand. Clark Davis of West Virginia Public Broadcasting has more.
BB&T CEO John Allison says the author Ayn Rand has changed his life.
My favorite book is Atlas Shrugged, which is the best defense, I believe, of capitalism ever written.
Over the last 3 years, Allison has helped ensure that Rand's philosophy receives attention at 25 colleges and universities. At Marshall, a $1 million grant would help create the BB&T Center for the Advancement of American Capitalism. Professor Cal Kent will direct the center. He says BB&T officials just want to give students an additional perspective on capitalism.
In my experience, you're not able to propagandize students, and BB&T recognizes that, and certainly that is not our intent in this course, and if it were our intent, we would be doomed for failure from the beginning.
At least one college has turned down BB&T's money. 2 years ago, faculty at Meredith College in North Carolina rejected $420,000. Professor Beth Mulvaney says many faculty were concerned the money would be used to promote economic propaganda, but that ultimately faculty didn't want to let a corporation have a role in curriculum.
The main concern that I heard articulated was the concern that no one outside of this college should ever tell an instructor what the reading for a course should be.
There are different definitions of Ayn Rand's philosophy. Critics like Rick Wilson often seize on what they consider its selfish aspects. Wilson, a sociology instructor at Marshall, heads what's called the West Virginia Economic Justice Project.
I think it's a curious interpretation of philanthropy to use corporate funding to promote sort of an extreme ideology. Ayn Rand's philosophy, which she called objectivism, is based on the view that selfishness is the only moral value, which seems kind of paradoxical. It goes against, I think, the collective wisdom of the human race pretty much everywhere.
Despite the criticism by some professors at Marshall University, Faculty Senate President Larry Stickler says it's too early to judge the course's merit. Dan Holbrook of the History Department, who at first objected, now says he's willing to give the course a chance.
I think that it's very easy to blow this out of proportion, and that I think the smart thing to do is to wait and see exactly how they teach those books, because there's no one right way to teach those books or to even read those books.
Rand is also the author of The Virtue of Selfishness. But Marshall's Cal Kent says her philosophy isn't so scary.
It's based on the idea of individualism. And what that means is individual choice. That means the freedom of individuals to contract with other people, the freedom to choose their occupations, the freedom to do what they see as being in their own best self-interest with the resources that they have.
Kent says BB&T probably wants to help business schools develop students that meet the bank's employment needs.
I'm sure it's not all altruism on their part, that this is really a way for them to get a foot in the door, a very large foot in the door in the recruiting process for better students.
Yes, Ayn Rand has written a book that is one of the best writings of the moral defense of capitalism.
Phyllis Arnold is president of BB&T's West Virginia operations.
But the subject at hand is forwarding and supporting the discussion and the knowledge of what capitalism brings to the success of our democracy and to the overall economic success of the country.
The course will be offered to both business and non-business majors starting next school year. For NPR News, I'm Clark Davis in Huntington, West Virginia.
Americans came to know Pat Tillman as a football star who enlisted after 9/11. The image in our heads is a square-jawed soldier in a beret. That's the photo that appeared on TV after he was killed in Afghanistan. One of the images in his mother's head is of Pat Tillman as a baby.
He was not a cuddly infant. Actually, he was a little malcontent. He didn't like being swaddled and held like most babies. He preferred to be upright. I remember I would sit in a chair and hold him up so he could bounce on my knees until my arms got so tired I could no longer hold him.
Mary Tillman put that memory in a book about her son called Boots on the Ground by Dusk. The military said Pat Tillman died heroically under enemy fire, then admitted he was killed by his fellow Americans. And last year, Acting Army Secretary Peter Guerin apologized.
We as an Army failed in our duty to the Tillman family, the duty we owe to all families of our fallen soldiers. Give them the truth, the best we know it, as fast as we can.
That apology was not enough for Mary Tillman. She did not agree with all the details of the Army's final story, didn't think enough people were punished. And last summer, she spent weeks studying hundreds of documents on the case. She made her own investigation of what happened in Afghanistan's mountains in 2004. Pat Tillman's platoon was sent to check a village for insurgents when, she says, it was hobbled by a disabled vehicle.
There was a broken Humvee that could not be repaired, and they were in a position where they had to kind of drag it in order to bring it along. And there were several options that the platoon leader had voiced, you know, leave the vehicle behind, bring it along. But in the end, he was in a position where he had to split the platoon and have one of the serials or convoys basically take it back to meet up with someone who could pick it up so they could repair it.
So you have Pat Tillman's platoon on this mission. They divide the force. Where's Pat Tillman in all of this?
Well, Pat is in the first serial.
So he's with the group that goes away from this towed Humvee and off its own way.
Right, and they go through this particular canyon. And the second serial is the serial that my other son, Kevin, was in. Pat's serial got through the canyon safely. The first vehicle in that serial took a wrong turn. And as they're turning around, they start hearing loud explosions, lots of firepower. And they basically assume that it must involve the second serial somehow, even though they were under the impression they were taking a different route. So they turn around, they get out of their vehicles to go try to assist. And Pat went up a ridgeline and got in a position where there were some rocks and he could see some enemy above the canyon walls.
So we got mountainous terrain. We've got soldiers in different locations. We've got American military vehicles moving in different directions. We've got some kind of harassing enemy fire coming from rocks somewhere and people trying to figure out what's going on all around them. Is this what you're saying?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Now, according to the Army, this vehicle came out of the canyon basically in a panic, in a fog of war, and shot up the ridgeline in a matter of 4 seconds. That is the story that ultimately we were told.
The story of Pat Tillman's death
right there.
Would you talk us through those last few minutes, what you believe happened, and tell us what you know as well as what you don't know?
Well, you have to understand, and I think it's really important that people realize that our family originally, when we learned of the friendly fire, we were very saddened by it. It's a horrible thing to know that your loved one was killed by his own men. We thought it was a terrible accident. But I think that after looking at the documents and talking to soldiers, I have a feeling that they didn't come out of that canyon in a fog of war. And their behavior was more of a adrenaline rush, a lust to fight. And one of the soldiers was asked, did you positively identify your target? And he said, no, I was shooting where everyone else was shooting. I wanted to be in a firefight. They also indicated that they saw people waving their arms And someone asked, well, what did it look like they were trying to tell you? And one of the soldiers responded, it looked like they're trying to say, hey, it's us. And yet they shot them anyway.
So you believe that the soldiers in this Humvee came out of the canyon. It was a combat situation. They were being fired on by the enemy. But then they failed one of the real grave tests, the difficult tests of discipline with a firearm, which is knowing when to stop shooting.
Right. And they admitted no one was shooting at them when they got out of the canyon. This was an harassing ambush. Certainly while they were in the canyon, it was probably extremely chaotic and frightening. I mean, Kevin was there. He said that it was frightening. But not one vehicle was even touched by enemy fire because the canyon walls were too high.
So these men saw some people on a ridgeline. They fired in that direction. And
yes.
Then what happened?
He was hit and he fell to what I'm assuming was a kneeling position, and then he was shot with what we believe was a 3-round burst from a sawgun in his forehead.
And was killed instantly.
Yes.
Well, Mary Tillman, having spent all this time trying to establish what the record is, and now to write this book to portray your son as the human being that he was, how do you want people to remember him?
Well, Pat was a complicated person. Everybody's complicated. It's hard to describe people in just a few words. But everyone who came in contact with Pat would say he was very honest. He was very loyal. He took responsibility for his mistakes. Everything that the government and the Army have not done for him. You know, but he was also a very inquisitive, curious person. He liked to read. He liked to inform himself.
Sounds like he got that from his mom.
Oh, he got that from lots of people in the family, and he got it from a lot of people he met along the way. And, I mean, he had tremendous influences from marvelous teachers, marvelous coaches, marvelous friends. And I want people to know that about him, and it's a tragic, horrible loss. You know, there are people that say, oh, well, you know, she must be just this really grieving mother and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Well, of course I'm grieving. I will always grieve for him. I will always miss him. We can't accept that he was treated with such disrespect and treated as a political tool, we believe.
Mary Tillman is author of Boots on the Ground by Dusk. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
You can find an excerpt from Mary Tillman's book at npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.